You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
And for Dear Science this week, we are joined by a new guest, our expert, Daniel. And you've got lots of science for us today, right?
Yeah, I do. It's great to be here. Thanks.
Hang on, I'll just move the mic a little closer. Yeah, so we've got lots of stories here, and in celebration of Kiribati Language Week, right?
Yeah, that's right. So it's Kiribati Language Week here in Aotearoa, so Wikin te Taitai ne Kiribati. And so I thought I'd choose some science stories that might where I might be able to find a connection to Kiribati, even if the stories aren't about Kiribati directly. Sound okay?
Yeah.
So I'll jump into it.
Yeah, the first one about rice in the Pacific. What's going on here?
Yeah, absolutely. So a little bit of background. So the most widely accepted theory for the origins of Austronesian people, so this includes modern Pacific peoples and hence the people of Kiribati, are migrations from Taiwan through the Philippines and then into the wider Pacific region starting at around 5,000 years ago. And so the last major land mass, of course, in these migrations to be settled is us here in Aotearoa. And in Aotearoa, where, you know, we know that these migration events involved incredible planning because of the Taonga species that were brought along, things like kumara for establishing colonies. Well, this new study has found the same type of planning in the earliest of these migration studies as well. And so the first evidence of rice entering the Pacific has been discovered in an ancient cave site in Guam, which is in the Mariana Islands in western Micronesia. So rice was originally domesticated in central China around 9,000 years ago and was brought into Taiwan and into the Philippines, where it was a staple food.
Yeah, big. I mean, lots of different cultures have their, you know, staple foods. We see potatoes in the Americas, right? Rice there, grains like corn and wheat in Europe mostly, I'd imagine.
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah. So rice, I mean, important to these people as food, but also culturally, I'd imagine, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so here is this staple food for this group of explorers that are about to head off on what would become a 2,300-kilometer journey from the Philippines out eventually into the Mariana Islands. And so it was these explorers that actually packed up staple foods that they'd use to establish their colony once they arrived, and that would include, of course, rice.
Mm.
And so that was the idea for the longest time, and it's only just now that the first evidence for this has actually been found.
Mm.
And so the presence of abundant rice husk and leaf phytoliths have been found. And so phytoliths are these glass-like structures that are found inside of rice plants. And so these phytoliths stay around long after the rice has gone. And so these things, these rice husks and these phytoliths, were found in the Ratidian site complex in Guam, and the pottery has been, or the sediments, and all of this structure has been dated to around 3,500 years
ago. Wow, so quite old. How well was it preserved, I guess?
Yeah, so preserved, these glass phytoliths are well preserved. They will preserve for a very long time. The evidence of the husks, these are actually just impressions pressed in against the pottery itself.
But still strong evidence that it was there. Yeah.
Well, the one thing they needed to check was actually, were these phytoliths or husks, were they actually in the pottery or were they on the pottery?
And right.
It makes a difference because perhaps they were part of the pottery and made elsewhere, or maybe they were put into the pottery on site and used for storage. And it's the latter. They were actually, this pottery was used to store this rice.
Yeah. And so, and then, I mean, you mentioned it earlier, but why are we not seeing, I guess, evidence of rice further or more recently than this in these places?
Yeah, so it turns out that once you arrive in Guam, there's not a huge amount of place to grow large fields of rice.
Yeah.
And so it is grown, or certainly was, and just in small scale. And so rice is used as ceremonial purposes, as you mentioned, and hasn't become a staple food. Instead, what we've seen is this shift towards the Oceania style of diet.
Yeah.
So seafood, coconuts, the traditional foods of what you'd find in Kiribati.
Very interesting. And then this next story about native forests sinking carbon. This is always nice, the fact that we have a little bit to offset the atrocious things we're doing to our atmosphere.
Yeah, and that's exactly what this story is. So I'm going to actually lead here with my Kiribati connection. And so that's because Kiribati has this unfortunate status of being the first country expected to disappear due to climate change. And that is because the area of Kiribati is so low-lying that rising sea level is an existential threat. And so understanding climate change, having a good sense of it, is obviously very important to all of us, but it's really close to home for people in Kiribati. And so this new climate change research actually is about Aotearoa forests. And it turns out that New Zealand's native forests are actually absorbing more carbon dioxide than previously thought.
Yeah, that's big, right? It's got to be good news.
Yeah, absolutely. And so a team led by staff at NIWA, so National Institute of Water and Atmospheric Research, have used an inverse modelling approach to figure this out. And so this inverse modelling is where you kind of know the answer, so you figure out the rest of the equation, what must be going on in order to arrive at the answer.
So we know, I'm guessing the answer is how much carbon is going away?
Yeah, is in the air around us.
Yeah.
And we know some parts of the other parts of that answer are how much we're sort of generating locally. So the missing piece there is how much is being absorbed to make all sense of this. And to put this into context, so we are actually producing around 78.8 million tons of carbon annually. And so that's a 2020 number. That's the closest that I could find. Earlier work had found that maybe New Zealand was absorbing 24 to 118 million. So
that's a big range.
It's a huge range. Yeah. And so maybe we were absorbing all of that we were producing, but maybe
maybe we were producing one third. Yeah, that range seems a bit unuseful.
Yeah, and so this group have come along with these more sophisticated methods using a longer series of data and really taken a good stab at it. And what they've found is that actually New Zealand's land ecosystems are absorbing 171 million tons.
That's got to be good.
Yeah, exactly. So it's a lot more than the 80-ish million that we're producing locally. So that kind of means that New Zealand is a net sink for carbon dioxide.
Well, that's great news.
Well, it is. And so the great thing about this is in looking here, they found that it's healthy, mature forests that are doing most of the work. And their big takeaway from this is anything that we do to make our forests healthier actually has this flow-on effect to making our atmosphere healthier. So healthy forests, good for climate change.
Yeah, and that's sort of intuitive, right? You'd imagine, you know, when the trees are doing well, they can do their job a bit better.
Yeah, absolutely. And so bringing this back to Kiribati, any efforts that we can do here in Aotearoa with our forests, make them healthier, makes the atmosphere healthier, slows down the rate that Kiribati might disappear under the ocean.
Yeah, and then this last story, seaweed used for grooming orcas. Seaweed, I mean, and grooming themselves. I mean, orcas, we know are smart animals, but I mean, grooming? Like, what's going on here?
Yeah, absolutely. So this one, I couldn't actually find a connection to Kiribati, but I saw this and I couldn't kelp myself.
That's good. I like that.
So tools are used by an increasing number of animals. But most of the animals that we see using tools, things like clever New Caledonian crows using sticks to solve puzzles, most of those animals live on land. We actually have relatively little evidence of animals using tools if they live in the ocean. And part of that's a bias. We live on land. That's where we're looking. But it turns out that orca have now been added to this list of tool users. There have been earlier observations of cetaceans. So cetaceans are whales, dolphins, porpoises of using tools, specifically kelp. So these animals having kelp draped over their bodies, a behavior called kelping. What is the porpoise of this. So possibly they're playing. Possibly it's skincare. A little unclear, but there are great images of things like grey whales wearing kelp hats that I highly encourage everyone to look up. But this is different. So in July last year, a group of researchers recorded orca in the Salish Sea, which is between Canada and the United States on the Pacific side. And what they were doing is they were swimming up past a piece of bull kelp, so a large floating raft of kelp, and they would bite off a stem of it, and they would grab a piece of that kelp and swim up to another orca and put that piece of kelp between the two orca, and then the two would swim along and roll against one another with that piece of kelp.
It sounds like quite an advanced process.
Exactly. Yeah. The planning that's involved, the choosing of the piece of kelp, the identifying the individual, having to swim to keep these pieces of kelp between them. Absolutely. So there's drone footage of this behavior happening between grandparent and a grandson, parent and daughter, sibling and brother. And so it was observed quite a few times. And what's been found is that mostly the orca that are doing this are doing this with close relatives or those of similar age.
Mm.
And so you asked, what's it for? What's going on? The best idea is that it's some kind of social skin maintenance.
Mm.
So these are animals that don't have hands. So anything that's affecting
just sort
their
of
skin,
rub up against each other.
Exactly. So it's a way of keeping the skin nice and clean, and it also helps reinforce social bonds.
Yeah.
So it's not referred to as kelping in this case. It's got a new term. It's allo-kelping.
Allo-kelping.
Exactly. Mm,
interesting.
So kelping others. And so this is where I do have a small Kiribati connection. Mm. So, and that is, I learned that helping one another in the Kiribati language is te ubopoki e maranana.
Mm, that's nice. Yeah, so if we're thinking about kelping or allo-kelping, right? I mean, obviously a skincare routine used by orcas, maybe now also used by humans. We can get together and rub a bit of kelp between us.
you can try it if you like.
Or take all the learnings of Dear Science with you, I suppose. Don't integrate all of them in your personal lives, but maybe this one, just for fun, inspire some thought in yourself, inspire some fun. That's nice to hear. All right, well, thank you for sharing these science stories with us, Daniel, this week. Very interesting stuff. Thank you, as always, to Mosette, and thank you, Science. We'll be right back after a short break. Keep it on the beat.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.